And it is Conversations, and I'm David Bush, sitting in for Richard Feidler for a few days this week. And my guest is former New South Wales Premier Christina Keneally. Christina was the 42nd Premier of New South Wales, but there is much more to her life than a political career. Christina's had an enduring parallel passion for feminist theology. And these two strands, politics and her Catholic faith, have formed an interesting weave since her university days. But it was also a sporting injury and experiencing perhaps her mother's worst nightmare that formed the background of her entry into Australian politics. That career in politics lasted a decade. It ended in 2012. And now Christina maintains a national profile as CEO of Basketball Australia and a patron of Stillbirth Australia. And she remains passionate and vocal about the Catholic Church. Christina Keneally, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you.
You've just been in a family reunion experience of the Caseys. This is your grandmother and mother side of the family.
Maternal grandmother.
Maternal grandmother, that's right. So what did you discover in that reunion? Who did you meet for the first time? What did you learn about your ancestry?
Well, I met 60 Australian relatives, which is about 58 more than I'd ever met previously. And fantastic. My fourth great-grandparents immigrated to Australia from Ireland 150 years ago. We put a plaque on their grave in Stanthorpe, Queensland this weekend. Never seen so many women who share my mother's hair color and skin coloring in one place. It was really remarkable. Genetics are an amazing thing, but I felt such an amazing sense of connection to an Australian heritage that really I hadn't known previously.
Well, your mother and grandmother are still alive. They're still in Ohio in the United States.
That's right.
So they didn't come over for this.
No, they left Australia in 1947, and my grandmother only came back once. So to be able to do the family research, make connections with her family, it's been a real blessing and a real treat for me.
So you're the daughter of an Australian mum and an American dad.
That's right.
How did they meet?
They met on an Air Force base in Florida. My Australian-born mother, her father's American, and her mother was obviously here from Brisbane, and her father was in the Air Force, and my parents met on an Air Force base, they were married on an Air Force base, and I was born on an Air Force base.
Genuine ancestor alliance going right back
that's right.
A number of generations.
Three generations of Australians marrying American. We do take that ancestor alliance very seriously.
So where is home for you, though? You had to renounce your US citizenship before you entered Australian politics. I think that was in 2000 when you renounced your citizenship. Was that a struggle for you to make that decision, to leave that kind of formally behind you?
No, I left home, my parents' home, when I was 18 to go to university, and I never really thought I would live in Toledo, Ohio, when I was once I'd left university. I don't think I'd contemplated going as far away as Sydney, but by the time I had decided to renounce my citizenship, Australia was very much my home. It was the place where my where I'd met my husband, where we were raising our children, where we had settled and decided to settle. And so it wasn't a difficult decision. It was in the middle of the Iraq War. So one of my girlfriends back in America thought I should go in and renounce it in protest of George Bush. I resisted. But the Americans did go to great pains to remind me that if I lost the election, I wouldn't be getting my citizenship back.
Oh, I see. You had to weigh that up very carefully then, given the circumstances. I recall Toledo, Ohio. Wasn't that where Klinger wanted to go
Klinger
back to?
From MASH.
From MASH. He wanted to be there. You couldn't see yourself going back.
No. The actor Jamie Farr is from Toledo, and they wrote that into the character, and he is one of our most famous exports, yes.
did your Australian-born mother tell you anything or much about Australia as you grew up? Was that an important part of kind of the family story that you were aware of even before you'd been here?
Oh, very much part of the family story. It was unusual to have, in Toledo, Ohio, to have a parent who was, in effect, an immigrant. And my grandmother, more than my mother, my mother left as a child, but my grandmother had lots of stories, and she had a funny accent as well, which was somewhat unusual. And I had, pen-palled with cousins who lived here and knew that there was a family connection and had hoped one day to come to Australia.
Mm, good. Now, you have two younger brothers, just looking at your family circumstances. Were you a good big sister?
Well, since they're in America and they can't speak
here. Well,
they
are now, but as you grew up as a kid, I mean...
look, my one brother is 4 years younger and another brother is 17 years younger. Mm, mm. So I have very little time in the same house as my youngest brother. But, yeah, they're both really interesting people, and I have good relationships with them now. And it's great to – we were just home at Christmas, and to see them and have that reunion with my American family was fantastic.
So born on an Air Force base, did you move around a lot as a kid?
We didn't. My father left the Air Force when I was about two, so we went back to his hometown, which was Toledo.
Toledo, okay.
And I grew up there until I went away to university in Dayton, Ohio, just about 2 hours south.
A lot of us would only have an understanding of what it is to have an American childhood from movies or sitcoms or
TV. Well, then
TV
you've got
series.
A good understanding of my childhood.
Is that right? Okay.
Very Midwestern, very middle class, you know, very kind of, you know, Happy Days, Brady Bunch, American movies, American TV, you know, homecoming games, football games, tailgate parties. That was all. It was a very classic American upbringing.
Oh, okay, good. What sort of a girl were you? How would you describe your personality as a kid?
I was a type A personality and probably still am a type A. Type A.
Okay.
Driven, ambitious, determined. Some people might say stubborn almost.
Type A and type B, I think, were originally a medical condition or a kind of a predisposition for coronary disease, actually, Christina. I hope you're not revealing some medical kind of...
No, I'm in pretty good health.
You'd have to be. But yeah, type A is certainly driven and ambitious, perhaps
yes.
A little impatient, doesn't suffer fools gladly.
Oldest child syndrome.
Competitive.
Competitive, driven to
high
succeed.
Stress.
Goal-oriented, yes,
there you go.
All of those things.
That's you. So how did you channel that ambition as a child and then growing into teenage years up off to uni?
In my childhood, both into academics and athletics, I was an incredibly competitive in both areas, but particularly sports. I just worked so hard at my athletics in high school and was determined. I got cut my first year of high school from the basketball team, and I was determined.
Ouch.
I was never going to be cut from a team again. And worked all summer in
Come
the
forward all these years, you're in charge of Basketball Australia. You know what it is to be cut out of a team.
That's right. So very driven. And I remember my father once saying, you know, the mothers on the team would say that blonde out there, she's playing dirty. And he'd say, no, she's playing the game the way it's meant to be played. You know, he very much had a view that he wasn't going to treat me any differently than he'd treat a boy. And he would teach me to play sports with all the same level of competitiveness and aggression. And years later in politics, I was very grateful that those skills had been instilled in me.
Was sport ever on the horizon for you actually as a career path? Did you see yourself as a professional sports person?
No, not as a career path. You know, I did play soccer incredibly well and indeed had started a university career but was injured very early on in my
cruciate ligament.
In my left knee, anterior cruciate ligament. And in those days... You know, now you can get the surgery and you can continue. In those days, it was far more invasive and far harder to recover from.
Well, two things to say about that. One is you really haven't gone back to the sporting field in a serious way since, have you?
No, not at all. I prefer to keep my knee intact these days.
The other is, though, that when soccer no longer was a kind of an exploit that you could pursue at university, student representative politics was. So let's just talk a bit about that and then look at what you were studying at uni. What was the draw into student rep politics for you? Why did you sort of think, I could do that?
Well, I'd always loved politics and been fascinated growing up. And indeed was studying communications, thought I might be a journalist covering politics one day. But after I injured my knee, I was a bit, well, to be blunt, bored. I was sitting around in my dorm room thinking, well, what am I going to do now? I've got to fill some time. And there was a flyer up on the wall to run for student government. And I thought, you know what? I think I'd enjoy that. And so I ran. I won. I ran again the next year, won again. And by my junior year at university, I was the vice president of the Student Government Association. And was getting involved in national student politics, so I just loved it. It was a bit competitive, a bit ambitious, but also a great way to live out a commitment to, you know, improving the world I lived in, and which was always something I'd been raised with, and so I really enjoyed the politics in student government.
Now you were studying political science, and you've got an honours degree in that, but you're also studying theology, feminist theology in particular. Why feminist theology? How had the Catholic faith been an informative part of your life to the point where you thought, I'm going to go to uni and study theology?
Well, I had been raised a Catholic, am a practicing Catholic, and, you know, I'm very much, you know, every part of my childhood was infused with the Catholic Church, you know, Catholic school. My mother taught at a Catholic school and parents active in the church, and very much around social justice, you know, improving the world in which you live, making your community a better place, living out your faith through good works, if you will. But when I was also raised very much a feminist, you know, both my mother and father, you know, didn't treat me any differently. And I remember very vividly when I was little once saying, I want to be a nurse or a teacher. And my mother, who was a teacher, said, you know, there are a lot of other things girls can do. And, you know, that's not to take anything away from nurses and teachers, but in the 70s, you know, my mother was very clear wanting to make sure that I understood I could do anything. My gender was not an issue. When I was eight, I called up the Catholic bishop who was on a talkback program and asked him why girls couldn't be altar servers. I thought it was a gross injustice that the boys in my class could be altar servers and I couldn't. His answer was very unsatisfactory.
To an eight-year-old, really. You could yeah. You could see through it.
And he set me off on a path to wanting to see the church change its attitudes towards women. And when I was at university in the late 80s, you know, it was a very interesting time. It was there was a lot of political activism around the church and around theology. You had liberation theology in South America, Central America. Yes, there was a time of Oscar Romero and Gustavo Gutierrez, and feminist theology was really coming into its own as a discipline. And, you know, as someone who was passionate about the Catholic faith, who was passionate about politics and sat on the left side of both of those things, these areas really fascinated me.
So you enrolled to study feminist theology. Now, this was the late 80s, as you say, and probably late 70s, early 80s, a large body of writing on feminist theology started to be published. The waves were really starting to roll through the church. What writers, what ideas really captured your theological imagination and your kind of heart that you felt, this is really stuff that I want to get into?
There were three women, and, you know, they're icons of the feminist theology, particularly Catholic feminist theology. Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, who wrote a book called In Memory of Her, and then later a book called Discipleship of Equals. Rosemary Radford Ruther, who wrote numerous articles and books, and who I cited, in fact, in my inaugural speech in the Parliament. And a woman named Elizabeth Johnson, who wrote a book called She Who Is and has written much more since. You know, these women, they interpreted the scriptures anew from women's experience. They said women's experience is a valid experience through which to interpret the scripture and the tradition of the Christian tradition and of the Catholic Church. And they found within scripture impulses and indicators of God understood as both male and female. They uncovered, you know, patriarchal domination, if you will, of Catholic tradition and interpretation of the scriptures over the last 2,000 years. And it was a very exciting, really almost heady time for particularly a graduate and undergraduate student to find these women and to find these things within your own tradition that you had a sense were always there. But to be able to study it and talk about it and debate it was just a very exciting period.
Given that priesthood wasn't even an option, whether you were going to consider that or not, and the roles in the church for women were so limited in the 80s, were you on a hiding to complete frustration with the church to get empowered kind of intellectually and then find there's no way to express that?
Well, I do reflect that perhaps I studied theology because there was no other option. You know, you couldn't be ordained either as a deacon or a priest. You still can't. I didn't want to be a religious sister. That was the option available. My father said at the time, could you pick a harder fight? and it is a very practical focused area of theology. But at the end of the day, it is still academic. And at a certain point, you know, I kind of thought I'm maybe in the circumstance here where I'm having the same conversation with the same 200 or 300 people for the rest of my career. And it's important people have those conversations. I do believe ultimately it changes what happens in the pews in the lives of ordinary Christians. But, you know, that was a real challenge for me. I'm a very practical, hands-on, want-to-get-things-done person. And an academic career, it was hard to see where that was going to lead.
So how did your feminist leanings and intellectual kind of empowerment feed into your political developing interest through student politics? Did the two come together comfortably for you, or did you find there were some tensions?
Look, I found they were largely complementary. Although I think it's important to understand in America, student politics is not really party political, and it's often more focused, particularly at a Catholic university, on the particular issues that affect Catholic universities. It's hard to translate into Australian experience, but there are 440 Catholic universities in America. And, they deal with issues like academic freedom and what role does the church have in determining what professors can teach, and things like, you know, the availability of birth control on campus.
Well, I was going to say, in the late 80s, you'd have had the AIDS crisis and birth control as two big issues. Were you comfortable in kind of spearheading the student political realm in all of that?
Very much so. I mean, I was the president. By that point, I was the president of the National Association of Students at Catholic Colleges and Universities, and we really did take on those issues, particularly in the light of the AIDS epidemic, and advocating for safe sex on campus and the availability of condoms on campus. And in hindsight now, it looks kind of almost quaint that was a debate that had to be had, but it really was at the time.
Did you win?
Largely, yes. I'm sure there are campuses where birth control was not available, but in the mainstream, I would say yes.
Just before we move off into the next part of your life, your master's thesis had an incredibly erudite title: Folding the Jesus-Sophia Metaphor, a Basis for a Non-Androcentric Christology Within a Christian Feminist Interpretive Community. Now, Jesus-Sophia Metaphor, that's Jesus whom we know, Sophia, wisdom, the kind of feminine aspect of God revealed to some extent through the Hebrew Scriptures, or at least denoted in the Hebrew Scriptures as a feminine description, perhaps, of God. Mm. Non-Androcentric Christology... Can you explain that to a non-specialist audience like me about that?
It's a fancy way of saying an understanding of Christ that isn't centered on the fact that he was male. So androcentric, male-centered. So it's about understanding the incarnation of God in the person of Jesus, but not focusing on the fact that was a gendered person. And what Sophia, the figure of wisdom in the books, particularly in the Catholic version of the Bible, the books of the wisdom books, Sophia is very much could be understood to be an incarnation of God. And indeed, many of the things that Jesus, the gospel writers later, the words they put in his mouth, the way they described him, were taken from those wisdom books. So it's really about finding a way to understand that when God became human, the important thing is that God became human, not that he became male, because God is neither male nor female. Now, to be truly human, God had to be one or the other, because that's what we,
that's what we are.
That's what we are. It is about finding that taking the emphasis off the maleness of Jesus Christ and more on the fact that the humanity and the ability to find in scriptures a reflection of both the male and female of God in the person of Christ.
So I hear an 8-year-old girl writing a master's thesis telling that bishop, it's not because I'm a girl that I can't do this.
Girls are now altar servers all over the world. So
you still were very active in the Catholic Church Institutional Day. You went off to World Youth Day in Poland, the third World Youth Day, which is where you met your future husband, Ben.
Yes. Thank you to the Vatican. They put us in dorm rooms across the hall from one another.
That seems a surprising.
Yes, it does. Although I think that whole World Youth Day, there's a small element of it that it's a Catholic dating service.
Was it for you when you went, or was there a much more noble kind of religious purpose for going?
Oh, I didn't go looking for a husband. No.
Okay, but you managed to find one.
I did manage to find one.
Just briefly, what were your impressions when you met Ben, and how was it that you kind of furthered the relationship?
My first impression is, wow, he's a bit arrogant. But I like arrogance. I like smart people.
Appeals to the type A in you,
perhaps. It does. And so I found him intriguing. He was both sort of a competitor, but also someone I found a kindred spirit. We both love politics. we both loved. We were both passionate about social justice. We both were more on the more progressive side of the Catholic Church. Our families were very similar. Our parents are very similar. And we just spent the whole 2 weeks we had together there talking. I don't think we ran out of things to say. And 20 years later, we still haven't run out of things to say to one another.
Oh, that's lovely. Okay. So you married and lived in Chicago for a time. I am sort of truncating your love story a little bit. And then you came to Australia. So just tell me about that journey. You married, you were in Chicago for a time, then you came to Australia. What was the decisions around all of that?
Well, the decision was actually before we went to Chicago, was to come to Australia as a permanent resident and before I was married. And that was a big leap of faith because, you know, I left everything. Everything behind, you know, family connections, career possibilities, everything, and came over here and started from scratch. And so it was, but it was the right decision in the end. You know, the sometimes the heart knows better than the head, and it was hard to make the decision to come. But when I did, you know, it's something I've never ever looked back and thought, gosh, I wish we'd settled in America. Never. And the sojourn to Chicago was for Ben's work, and we were both very keen to get back to Sydney.
And you'd had Daniel, your first son, by then.
Yes.
So coming back to Australia was a reconnection with that side of the family.
Mm.
Not long after, you had another, you fell pregnant again with a daughter, Caroline. And that was a tragic outcome.
It was very tragic. She was stillborn. She had a birth defect that meant she couldn't survive outside the womb. And I felt, you know, so many things at that time. It was an incredibly difficult period. And you know, ultimately, I look back at the time, I just felt incredibly naive about pregnancy. My first pregnancy had been such a breeze. And, you know, who knew stillbirth still happened? Well, now we know it happens 6 times a day in Australia. It's one of the leading causes of death for children under the age of one.
How far through the pregnancy were you when that discovery was made?
I was about 5 months through. I could have carried Caroline to term. There was no reason I couldn't have, but we made a decision because Daniel was 13 months old at the time to have her early. You know, but I held her. We buried her. I spent time with her before we buried her. You know, it was an amazing, awful, tragic time. I mean, to go into labor knowing that your child will not survive, to give birth knowing that your child will not be alive, and then to, you know, have all that time, you know, in the hospital afterwards, which is usually joyful, and for me it was just sad. It was constantly sad. And then to have to plan her funeral. You know, that was the hardest thing I have ever had to do. And yeah, there aren't words to describe it. It was so awful.
How did you get through it? Where were the supports for you?
An amazing, amazing social worker through the hospital, Liz. She just helped me through that time. My mother came over for a period of time, but you know, it took forever. It took what felt like forever. It took years. You know, probably up to 2 years, really, to start to feel like myself again. And that was the time when I decided to stop studying my PhD because the solitude of research just was not helping with the grief. I also just felt a desire to do something with my life, to make a difference with my life, because I started to realize life is pretty short.
Was it a faith crisis for you? Did faith questions come into it?
Yes, absolutely. I was angry at God for a long time. You know, why was my baby not with me? Why was, you know, I believed that my child was with God, but I didn't understand why she needed to be there and not with me. And I spent a lot of time being angry. And then it just struck me one day, if I truly believe that God is both male and female, then God is a mother whose child has died. You know, God's child died, and God understands. You know, and bad things do happen in the world, and God understands my pain and suffering. And it was a moment of almost grace and relief and a sense that it was okay. Yeah, I have a very powerful memory of being at church one night and just this sense of, you know, it's all going to be okay. She's okay, I'm okay, it will be okay. Now, that's not to be simplistic. It was a lot there was a lot of work that went into getting to feel okay again. But, you know, and I'm sure people who do not have faith can deal with these things. But for me, looking back, I don't know how I would have dealt with the idea that Caroline's life just stopped on her death. The comfort I had ultimately that she was with God, that her soul continued to exist, that it wasn't the end of her existence, was very comforting for me.
You're listening to Conversations on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
And you're with me, David Bush, my guest, Christina Keneally. Christina, we've been talking about the experience of Caroline being stillborn. This was before you entered politics, became Premier of New South Wales. We've talked about your Catholic faith and the influence of that. You are now patron of Stillbirth Australia, which is a group that is brought together by grief but has a very strong mandate for public education and so on. Tell me how that group seeks to change public perceptions and awareness of the stillbirth issue in Australia, because it's probably, as you say, we're not really very much aware of the phenomenon.
Stillbirth Foundation seeks to raise money for research, direct and lobby for government investment into research, and ultimately to advise people the outcomes of research that can help prevent stillbirth. You know, it does happen 6 times a day. Most people think stillbirth is a problem of their grandmother's generation. The reality is it's a tragedy we rarely talk about because it is so devastatingly sad. But research is the cure to unlocking that. You know, and I point to sudden infant death syndrome, which has had an 85% drop in the incidence of SIDS due to the money that's gone into research. And there are plenty of promising leads that would suggest that we can identify and reduce the reason stillbirth happens as well.
Was it difficult for you and Ben to make a decision to go for another child?
Well, the condition that Caroline had is something that runs in sibling groups, and they don't know why it occurs, but it does. I had always wanted to have, you know, 3 or 4 children. We did decide we wanted to have another child. I very much wanted to have a brother or sister for Daniel, and we did make that decision. And Brendan, my second son, he was an incredibly healthy and is now an incredibly healthy boy. But I did decide not to have any more children. I didn't want to take the risk either for myself or for my family that we would go through that tragedy again.
Mm. And to take nothing away from Daniel or Brendan as delightful boys.
They're very delightful.
Do you grieve not being the mum to a girl?
No. I have a view about life that, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, my life is what it is. I am the mother of 2 boys and 1 girl who died at birth. And, you know, I honestly don't sit there and think, what would it be like if she was here? She's not here, and I accepted that a long time ago.
You keep her memory very much alive. She's still part of the family, as you say. You're the mother of Caroline, and she's still part of how you describe your family situation.
She is, and you know, we have photos at home, and you know, I visit her grave on Mother's Day and on her birthday, and you know, my children, you know that she's part of our lives. You know, it's not as if you know she's there every moment or every day, but you know, in certain circumstances, you know, the death of my grandparents or my father-in-law recently, you know, she was remembered in the prayers. My family very much recognizes her as a part of our family.
If you are wanting to talk to parents, mums in particular, who've had the experience of having a stillborn child, what do you say to them to give them encouragement and help and support?
Well, it depends at what stage they're at. You know, if it's a newly experienced tragedy, it's just comfort. Yeah, I met some people the other day, and it's 6 years ago, and the father was saying to me, you know, I don't know how, you know, I struggle with other challenges in my life. And I made the point, I said, you know, if you can survive being the parent of a stillborn child, there's almost nothing else life can throw at you that can be as hard as that. And, you know, and I firmly have always believed that there is nothing that I would go through in my political or professional life that would have been as hard as what I went through personally.
Which for you, the political career you had was certainly a very fraught one, and there were a lot of tough challenges. So I'm assuming or imagining that the resilience, even some toughness from that experience, carried through into what you took into politics.
Without a doubt, without a doubt.
Is there a flip side of that about tenderness, though? Because you also know life is mortal and people have feelings, and there is an emotional side that actually is more important, the heart more than the head. Mm. How did you balance the toughness and the tenderness as a politician?
Well, the toughness came pretty early on. I had a really difficult pre-selection. People were, you know, spitting at me and calling me names. And I kind of almost had this sense of calmness. I thought, you know, there is nothing you can say about me or do to me that can hurt me as much as I've been hurt. So, you know, bring it on, you know, because I am tougher than you realize. And I think a lot of people underestimated me in the first, you know, first part of my career or even later in my career because they didn't know my life story or who I was. But I also found once I got into office, and, you know, being an MP, the side the public don't see is that you're almost like a counselor or a parish pastor, a priest. People come to you with their most difficult, awful personal circumstances and hoping you can help. And it was that where I could feel a sense of empathy and sadness and even cry with people when they sat in my office telling me these most horrible, difficult, challenging stories.
I'm assuming you're talking about people in your seat.
Electorate, my constituents.
Indeed, not your fellow politicians for whom vulnerability could be very risky.
Although it was interesting later on when I was the leader of my party, and sometimes you do have to deal with difficult things, and not all the things I'm talking about here are things that ever became public, but, you know, often sometimes people would come to me within the party to share something with me to let me know why they needed to be away or what something that was happening, and I would find they would cry in front of me, and I later on I would think, I wonder if they would have been so emotional in front of a different type of leader. And I hope that people, you know, felt that I was able to be empathetic in those circumstances. It was, you know, there's a lot of that goes on in politics that is very emotional, because politics is not a entirely rational field. It is often about the person, and the political is the personal, and often people bring their life stories into it.
It's a very bruising enterprise. Do you think we actually undersell, underrate, undermine the political process by having a view of politics being so tough, and that very vulnerability, the human side, which you as a leader kind of shared in those quieter moments one-on-one, we never get to see, and we just forget that our politicians are people with their own human stories. Do you think that actually skews our political discourse in a way that's ultimately unhelpful? It makes us cynical or, destructive of politicians as people?
I think if you're a politician, it is a really hard choice about what you talk about publicly and what you reveal of yourself, because it is a harsh climate, the Australian media landscape. And, you know, the public at the one hand, you know, somebody once said to me, you know, politics is celebrity for ugly people. and in the sense that politicians like, you know, people like they want to know a bit of your family and your children and your life story. And but yet what they do with that, you can't really control. And, you know, the thing about your public life is you've chosen it, but the rest of your family hasn't. And so I was always very mindful, particularly when my boys got older. You know, it was their choice if they wanted to be in a photo. It was their choice if they wanted to come with me to something. It was my husband's responsibility to speak for himself. I didn't speak for him. And so, you know, right up to even the night I resigned, I did it by myself, because on the stage I didn't have the family up there with me, because I thought, this isn't their burden, it's mine. Mm-hmm. And it's mine to carry. And my children didn't need that memory for the rest of their lives. You know, that was my choice to put myself up as the leader. It's my choice to take responsibility for the result. And
so there's a compartmentalization, really, isn't there, of your life. You've got to say, there's my public life, there's my private life.
I think all politicians do that, and they have to. It's a coping mechanism.
One of the great experiences, I'm sure that you would think it was a great experience in your political career, was when you were the minister responsible for World Youth Day in Sydney in 2008, when the Pope visited, and that was a great celebration, although the lead-up was one of great cynicism and media were quite hostile to it. Just reflecting back briefly, what was the highlight for you of that experience, being the minister on the spot, making sure this event ran well across all government services, big responsibility, something dear to your heart, and yet it was a fairly suspicious or hostile public anticipation of it?
Oh, there's so many things I could say about World Youth Day. The lead up to it was, you know, it was almost hysterical. It was hysterical. I'll just name that. It was a hysterical response from the media about government support for the event. I knew, because I'd been through two World Youth Days, that once it started, the public would love it. These people, these young people would come and they would be optimistic and happy. And sure enough, that is exactly what happened. You saw at the moment the first plane load of pilgrims came through a Sydney airport. The coverage changed instantly. And, you know, but at the same time, I had to worry about trains and health and, you know, flu epidemics and flash flooding and every other, you know, possible tragedy that could have occurred. But I remember at one point just sitting in Circular Quay, and like I had about 5 minutes between doing different things and watching just this city be so vibrant and alive and happy, and thinking, wow, this is such a satisfying thing that we've pulled this off flawlessly, and this is such a happy place this week. So from both a professional and a personal level, it was just great to see the city. And Sydney is not always a happy city. It is not always an optimistic place. And to see the city just infused with that joy for that period was terrific.
Was your heart in the mouth in relation to terrorism threats or some other great catastrophe that just might have completely shrouded the event?
Absolutely. You know, yeah, the level of planning that goes into an event like that. It was the largest event on earth after the Olympics in 2008. So the level of planning. And I remember thinking there, you know, we had everything, you know, everything planned. You know, police, security, transport, health, food, blankets, you know, the whole thing. And it was complex event. And I remember thinking, you know, I went to Poland for World Youth Day when I was 22 with 1.4 million people, which is about a million more than we had in Sydney. I'm pretty sure they didn't have all these plans in place. And how naive would I have been as a young person going off to it? But, you know, I barely slept that week. You know, you had to be up until the last pilgrim got home, and you had to be up then the next morning at 4:30 to start the round of meetings. But it was an amazing experience. It was an amazing experience to be responsible.
It's hardly the kind of experience one would expect Catholic youth to come and be radicalised by, but you were a fairly radicalised Catholic youth yourself when you went to Poland. What's the role of that kind of event? Is it just a big jamboree and a celebration of Orthodox Catholicism, and the Pope comes and it's a big kind of tribal gathering, if you like? Or do you hope there's actually a much more serious challenge to the Church and to the young people who come?
It's funny you ask that question, because I've seen World Youth Day change since I first went. Now I sound like some, you know, youth in my day were far more radical, but they were. the conservatism of the pilgrims who came to Sydney just floored me. You know, when in World Youth Day in 1991, there was a, particularly from the Western Church, there was a lot more, you know, pushing the boundary on discussions. This was much more Orthodox, and it kind of struck me as a bit strange almost. I expected it to be a different type of crowd. But, you know, that might say a bit about what's happening with the Church in America, and in particular, and in Europe, that it's attracting a far more Orthodox, conservative group of young people. Or it's alienated people, people like me who have views about women and birth control that are, and other issues that are not in accordance with Church teaching.
One of the portfolios you held in ministry was for disability services, and there's an interesting link now with your Basketball Australia role, where you're chief executive officer, that you actually have responsibility for the wheelchair.
That's right.
Basketballers, that's the gliders is the women's and the rollers the men's. Tell me about the importance of disability services generally for you personally, given your experience of, you know, families doing it tough and the sort of tragedies or circumstances that can change family situations.
I grew up with an uncle with an intellectual disability, and my mother was always very keen to make sure we understood and appreciated people with a disability and their contributions and their value. And that carried on into my later career. I was particularly pleased, and I love being Minister for Disability Services. It's where you can truly live out your commitment to social justice. And yeah, when I was in office, we increased funding to disability by massive amounts, $1.3 billion, and then again another $2 billion. And New South Wales was the first to put forward the idea of a national disability insurance scheme. So, you know, I will be incredibly proud when one day Australia has that in place.
When you became Premier, there were two immediate challenges. One was your personal life, I suppose, and how you would then even more live in the public life without that impacting on your husband Ben and your children, Daniel and Brendan, and you've talked a little bit about that. But the other was the shadow of the factions. And I'm just curious now, as a Catholic, the New South Wales Right, which is the factional base that propelled you to the premiership, if you like, or stood behind you, however you want to talk about their particular role in all of that. It's got a very strong Catholic conservative base. You're a Catholic yourself. And just looking back at the role of a conservative Catholic group in the New South Wales Right of Labor politics, how do you see that? How do you critique that as an appropriate or necessary but ultimately unhelpful relationship between church and politics, between the way Catholic or religious groups caucus together and seek to influence political outcomes and political agendas?
Well, it's a funny question, because on the one hand, you could look around the cabinet or the caucus and see a lot of Catholics. And I remember when I first moved to Australia thinking, where are all the young, active Catholics? A lot of them were in the Labor Party, as it turned out. And I do think politicians are people who are more likely to be practicing a religious faith, because often they are joiners. They're people who join things. They get involved in stuff. So it's perhaps not surprising. Where I am going to disagree with you slightly is that the Catholic influence is not limited to the New South Wales Labor Right. The Deputy Premier, John Watkins, leader of the left, practicing Catholic. Mm-hmm. Luke Foley, who is now the most prominent member of the Labor left in New South Wales. Mm-hmm. Luke Aquinas Foley, practicing Catholic. The Premier of New South Wales is a Catholic. At the time when I was a backbencher, John Brogdon, leader of the opposition, was a Catholic. The Liberal Party has just as many Catholics and perhaps more. David Clark, a very notable figure there. Mm. Yeah, I don't know that you can say the Labor right or the Labor left in the Catholic Church. I think you can say that people of religious faith often go into politics. Unfortunately, not all politicians live by the faith and morals we might like them to, and that was certainly a challenge I faced. That there were a few scandals I had to deal with, but I don't think any of that had anything to do with whether or not someone was Catholic. But I do think there was a really interesting period there in New South Wales, in particular, where Catholicism went from being the religion of the Labor Party to being the religion of the Liberal Party as well.
The whole shadow of factionalism really did kind of, to some extent, sit over your premiership, because people wouldn't believe that you were there on your own, that you were actually part of a patronage system. And John Faulkner, I think a couple of years earlier, talked about factionalism being more about patronage than about ideology. So does it frustrate you that, whether or not it's true, there is a perception out there that you were fighting all the time, that you were Premier because of a set of arrangements that were made behind the scenes and not because you, ambitious and driven and competent as you would have seen yourself, were able to get there for yourself?
Oh, look, a lot of things frustrate you, but, you know, what do you do? You live your life and you know yourself, and you know that you're judged by your actions at the end of the day. And, you know, I never particularly got too fussed about what the media said and the newspapers. You know, they're today's newspaper is tomorrow's fish and chip wrapper. In the end of the day, history speaks for itself. Yes, was I supported by a group of people in a particular faction? Yep. Did they support me unanimously? No. You know, you look at the votes that were taken to put me into office. Clearly, that faction did not vote as a bloc. There were people who voted for Frank Sartor. You know, he was only two votes away from becoming premier. So, you know, it's hard to make an argument, particularly that it was just a patronage system. And, you know, I will say this: I get a little frustrated when I see a supposed elder statesman of the party decrying a factional system that they've benefited from throughout their entire careers. You know, factions have always been part of all political parties, and anyone who's achieved anything in a political party has done so with the support of a faction.
March 2011, a great defeat for your government, 17% swing, I think the largest in electoral history. In fact, it was a very ignominious end to the Labor government. How hard is it not to take that personally? Of course, the whole government takes responsibility, but you're the leader. How hard does it not come as a judgment against you?
I knew a year out from the election that it was not possible for us to win. You know, we had gone through, when I first became premier, for about 6 months, things were going swimmingly well, and we were improving about one percentage point a fortnight, and we were in a winnable position. And then we had a month where we had just had four scandals in a row. Our vote plummeted, and I remember saying to my chief of staff, we can't win. But we have to act as if we can win, and we have to inspire our people to work as hard as possible, and we're never going to concede publicly or privately. You know, the strategy to win as many seats as possible is the same as the strategy to win. So that's the strategy we put in place. I knew my job was to bring dignity to the end of 16 years of government and to set the party up for opposition and then to save as many seats as possible. You know, people were predicting we would win 10 seats. We won 20. And, you know, I'm pleased that they're in that position. Would I like them to have more seats? Of course. You know, but I think, you know, we've seen in other elections subsequent and we're, you know, facing some very tough electoral circumstances. I think, you know, there's a lot of, this is not just, as someone once famously said, a New South Wales disease. There is a real challenge on what it means to be a Labor Party in the 21st century. And I think that's a challenge that the Labor Party faces in Australia.
And you're not entirely out of public political life because your husband Ben is mayor of Botany Bay.
Making me the mayoress.
The mayoress, there you are. Who would have thought, from premier to mayoress. There you go. What for you is the appropriate relationship between religion and politics? Because we see it expressed in many different ways. We have lobby groups that are quite explicitly Christian. We have the Catholic Church in its varying lobbying manifestations wanting to achieve certain outcomes. And then you have people who hold beliefs that are exercised privately or to some degree publicly across the spectrum of politics, as you've alluded to. What for you is the appropriate relationship between a person's political commitments and their religious faith and commitment?
Well, as an individual politician, I think you always have to be honest about your motivations and your thinking and your how you've arrived at a position, particularly on social and moral issues. And I always sought to do that whenever I spoke in conscience votes about same-sex adoption. We didn't have a vote on same-sex marriage when I was in Parliament, on same-sex adoption, on according greater rights to people in same-sex relationships or on stem cell research. I always put that within the context of my Catholic faith. Now, sometimes I vote in accordance with my, you know, I would have voted in alignment, might be the way to put it, with my Catholic faith. And other times I voted contrary to the teachings of the Catholic Church. But I always was very conscious that this was a part of who I was and was a part of my thinking. And both as a Catholic and as a politician, I wanted to be clear about that with the public. I have no concerns about people of religious faith being part of politics. I have no concerns about churches, you know, being part of the conversations on social and moral and legal issues. Obviously, I would have a problem if we had an official religion, or concerns about prosecution or persecution of particular religious views. You know, at the same time, I've always been, you know, very honest about who I was, and I think at the end of the day that the public wants people to be genuine about who they are in politics. They can sniff a lack of genuineness a mile away.
You sit somewhat loosely to the Catholic Church these days in terms of participation. How do you nurture your spirituality these days? What inspires you? What nourishes you as a Christian, a Catholic?
Oh, you know, this is a big question. I'm on a journey, and right now I think a lot of Catholics in Australia are really struggling, given the sex abuse scandals, the views the church holds on women, on people of same sex relationships, on sexual morality. I do struggle. I still attend church. I attended church this morning, but often it's a real struggle. About am I in or am I out? And I take the view that for me, what's important, the person of Jesus and what he taught. Everything else that came after about who can be priests and who can get married to who, and that's all interpretation that came after. Jesus said, love one another as I have loved you. And in moments of doubt, that's what I come back to.
Mm. Your life has really been driven by what might be called a sense of moral purpose. Post-politics, you're now CEO of Basketball Australia, a lot of involvement in sporting groups and Stillbirth Australia, as we've mentioned. Does your life have that degree of moral purpose that you would like, or are there still things you think you'd like to get involved in for that reason?
My life has it. I don't know that my job has it, and that's a new experience for me. Every other role, every other job I've had has had some form of, saving the world. sport, you're not saving the world. And I love what I'm doing, but I miss that part of it, that moral purpose. So I try to find that in other ways, whether it's the Stillbirth Foundation or other volunteer work that I do, to be giving something back. That's a big motivator in my life, and it's something I don't think will ever change.
Is Pope Francis giving you some hope for the church, or are you uncertain?
Early signs, yes. His symbolic gestures, which are important, have been significant, washing the feet of men and women, of juvenile detention inmates, of people of the Islamic faith, of women of the Islamic faith. I mean, that's hugely symbolic what he did there. Some of his symbols around, simplicity and poverty, very symbolic, but he's got to really deal with some big issues coming up. And I think that's when we'll see where he's going to take the church and his papacy.
Christina Keneally, it's been great to have you on Conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.